Hello and welcome, friends. In this episode, I sit down with ecotherapist, rewilding coach, and outdoor skills practitioner Kimberly Beck as we explore ways to reverse the ill effects of our divorcement from the natural world due to human domestication. Kimberly shares her nature-connected background, as well as healing experiences and epiphanies she had, which led her down the path of learning the principles of therapy and how to facilitate a relational reconnection between people and the natural world. Kimberly expounds specifically on rewilding and how it fits into the ecotherapy conversation of reunifying people with nature. We talk about ways that people project on the natural world and others, and what one can learn by properly observing and asking questions about one's projections. Kimberly offers stories of experiences with clients, exemplifying ways that nature-connecting events can become an anchor for those struggling with mental illness. We also discuss the natural ability of the awareness skills, such as tracking, bird language, and naturalist knowledge, to facilitate ecotherapeutic self-exploration. We explore the importance of play and its role in helping people become fully realized human beings, as well as other nature reconnective activities that can be incorporated into one's life. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Wilderness and Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Ron Wallin. This podcast is an exploration of the ways that people can reconnect to the natural world through bushcraft, naturalist skills, and time spent immersed in the nature they find around and within them. We also discuss how this reconnection can increase our individual well-being and that of our communities and the earth. Thank you for joining me. I'm really glad you're here. Hello, friends, and welcome back to the podcast. Glad to have you join us once again for another episode talking about the natural world and the wonderful ways that it can help us to heal and become better, more fully realized people. So this was a really fun episode with Kimberly Beck. This came about as from basically a message she sent me on Facebook, just giving some good marks for the podcast and excited about the project. And, you know, I looked into her because I didn't know Kimberly before this and was really impressed with the work that she's doing. So, and we haven't had a real kind of in-depth conversation about ecotherapy. And so I thought it'd be great to have her on to talk about that particular subject. And what a fun conversation it was. We got in pretty in-depth into a lot of great things, and a lot of really good gems came out of this conversation. Just a couple of quotes that kind of came out. One, she said something that really kind of hit hard to me, and she said basically that she's not doing ecotherapy because nature heals. She's doing nature-based and ecotherapy because the divorcement from nature harms. And I thought that was really interesting. And she also talked about the concept of us as human beings being like domesticated animals and gave a really great analogy of that. So please look forward to that in this conversation. And then she also passed along a little bit of knowledge from one of her mentors, John Stokes, that I hadn't heard before and really hit me profoundly. And that is that the power of your awareness determines the quality of your life. So again, look for that as well. And just a really fun conversation. So with that, I will go ahead and introduce Kimberly to you. Kimberly's passion is facilitating relationship between people and nature, people and animals, and people and people. As a naturalist, humane educator, ecotherapist, nature mentor, and dog trainer, she considers herself to be living her childhood dreams. She attributes her relationship with nature as a primary protective factor in her own emotional and psychological resilience, and hence chose to blend nature and psychology in her work. Kimberly values helping others improve their health, confidence, relationships, and sense of belonging in the world by restoring the original kinship we humans share with nature. She believes the health of people is absolutely intertwined with the health of our ecosystems, and hopes that reestablishing natural, native connections will generate more compassionate attitudes and actions towards ourselves, one another, and the planet upon which we depend. Along with running Relational Rewilding, Kimberly currently works as coordinator and faculty for the Gestalt Equine Institute of the Rockies, teaching nature-based approaches to therapy. Kimberly holds a master's degree in counseling from Colorado State University and a bachelor's degree in outdoor education and plant biology from Ohio University. She has been practicing nature-based and ecotherapy for 10 years. Kimberly designed and led environmental and humane education programs at state parks, outdoor education centers, and animal shelters throughout the country. She is a master naturalist, a native plant master, and certified interpretive guide. Kimberly has participated in continuing education programs through the Colorado School for Clinical Herbalism, The Forager's Path, Artemisian Root Herbalism, Somatic Wilderness Therapy Institute, Wildcraft Forest School, Wilderness Awareness School, Eight Shields Institute, and The Tracking Project, training in cultural and natural awareness, animal tracking, plant studies, herbology, bird language, primitive skills, community building, and gestalt and nature-based therapy. She lives in the foothills of West Golden, Colorado, with her partner, three horses, and a diversity of surrounding wildlife. And that's from Kimberly's website, Relational Rewilding Nature Guiding, of which you can find, of course, in the show notes. So without further ado, I will pass you along to our conversation.
I'm really excited about what you're doing up there, because, you know, I see a lot of the, you know, I do see some, you know, here's the ecotherapy, or here's the skills, or here's the naturalist stuff. And you really have taken everything and just put it into one, and are doing programs like Serene. And to me, that's really what it's all about, you know, is because, and not that other ecotherapy programs aren't blending those things, but it's just not as pointed, I guess. So it's fun to see that.
Yeah. My way of doing it is a little different.
So I'm curious about that. How so? Because I don't know the eco. I mean, I know what ecotherapy is. I you know, that's something I studied during my master's program in that, but not having actually worked in that field or things like that, I'm not sure how, you know, how it's commonly disseminated to the people, I suppose.
Sure. And I mean, I guess I cannot speak for everybody that's doing ecotherapy out there, because obviously I don't know. Just from my limited view of being, I've been in multiple fields. And I came to the therapeutic field late. And my history, my background was primarily environmental education, outdoor education, nature connection world. Like that was right. And animal welfare, animal rights, like that whole world. And then later came the graduate school and the therapeutic part. And as I moved into the ecotherapy part, which actually, from my perspective, for myself, I created it because I didn't know it existed. I just knew that I came from doing nature connection and nature education work. I got a calling to go into therapeutic work, and I was going to blend them. I didn't know it existed. I had no clue.
Oh, interesting.
So I actually approached the ecotherapeutic world from the nature connection, nature education, whereas a lot of people in the doing ecotherapy, they come at it from the therapeutic world first, and they have a deep love, care for, and reverence of nature. And so they want to blend that, and they know about the healing aspects of nature, and so they blend it.
Right.
So we all end up at the same point.
Yeah.
But we come from slightly different backgrounds, which ends up influencing how we do the work and what types of interventions and experiments that we do with people.
Okay.
So
interesting.
That's kind of a quick and dirty. I can go into so much more detail about every single aspect of that.
We will get there for sure.
We'll get there. Totally.
So tell me about like kind of your overall background, like growing up and all that. What was it that sparked your curiosity and interest in nature and all that?
Sure. Well, I think like you and a lot of your guests as well, had a natural affiliation with the natural world since I was an infant. And the other factors layered on top. I mean, I think everybody has that. I don't think that that's unique to us. I think everybody has that. But the other factors that were supporting that was that I grew up in a time where there wasn't the screens and the games and all of that type of stuff. And my parents would, you know, go outside and play and come back for dinner and bedtime.
Right.
I also had a mother that could tell, she was able to read my very early affiliation for animals and for the natural world. And she supported that. And so
nice.
Almost any activity, you know, it's like whether we go on vacations, the books that we got, everything that I got had a theme of animals and nature. And so then I was constantly surrounded, you know, taking me to zoos and to SeaWorlds. And while I have other thoughts about some of those places now, they were completely instrumental in developing that love and to be able to have closer contact with those beings. And also to be able to talk to people working in those fields, because we would stay after and I'm like, can we go talk to the trainer? And we would, you know, and so I had access to that. So I think that the time that I grew up in, having more freedom, more outside playtime, having parents that were supportive of my love, was really the greatest spark. And to me at that point, just now in reflection, looking back, it was like nature became a primary attachment figure for me. And I think that it does for a lot of people that have that kind of a background, where nature becomes another caretaker for us, you know, when
interesting, almost like another parent. Is that
like another parent? Yeah. Absolutely. And it's another part of your personal community. I mean, attachment people, you know, when you're talking about attachment, you're talking about relationship and you're talking about trust. And most people put that together with parents or caregivers, which obviously is incredibly important and a part of that. But often what is left out is the larger mother of the earth, and how that we do as Homo sapiens have a natural attachment to that. As long as we're allowed to have access and time with that. So, those pieces were, I think, pretty important in that. And then as I got older and things got tougher, things were also rough at home,
right.
For other reasons. And nature was my refuge. My cat was my refuge. The maple trees outside my yard were my refuge. And so they also became a considerable protective factor, I think, in that. So it was like I had this other mother, which was more, you know, kind of a community member, and was also protecting me and was continuing to remind me that the world is actually an okay place to be. Even though things are really difficult and things are not optimal in the home, a lot of times outside of the home, I was just like, but the world's actually still an okay place to be. So I always felt safe because of that. So that was pretty significant. Yeah. And then as I got older, again, my mom always supported continuing. So like one of my first jobs was as a park ranger at a local state park.
Yeah.
And that was mind blowing to me at the time. And we did everything in that job. You know, we did ecological restoration. That's when I very first started doing outdoor.
How old are you at this point?
It's like 18 or 19.
Oh, how awesome is that?
Yeah, it's an early experience.
That's a great first job.
And my parents were all about me getting a job, which is fine.
Right.
Which is great. And my mom would take me to the state park and she's like, maybe you can get a job here. And she'd be like, she would help me like talk to the rangers and ask questions and things like that. So I had that kind of support where I was an introvert and I was a little shy and I don't know if I would have done that on my own.
Yeah, mom.
And so I did, I applied and they knew me because I had gone and talked to them a couple of times and they hired me for a seasonal position. And it was so diverse, the work that we did, you know, working with wildlife, protecting wildlife, working with people, teaching people how to protect wildlife, learning how to use a chainsaw, going on the boat, on the river or on the lake. And so it was just, they're so diverse. And I left that job and I'm like, I'm going to do all of this all the time.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So that was pretty instrumental. And then I was going to college around that time as well. And I was like, okay, how do I do all of this all of the time? So I just got into all of the ologies.
Yeah.
Biology and wildlife biology and marine biology. And, but it wasn't quite getting it.
Our modern education system is really good at transmitting information and really bad at connection.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was like, I'm like, but I want to connect with those, and I want to connect other people with the marine biology and with the wildlife and with the plants. So I'm like, where is this? And finally, after, I mean, I had been in college for 3+ years, and I think I was on my third university as well. I moved around a lot. Finally, an advisor was like, oh, why don't you go to the outdoor education program? And I was like, that sounds about right.
You're like, that exists?
Exactly. I was like, I had no idea that existed. So I went in, and it was like square peg, square hole. Like, it was a perfect fit. I also took, that's also when I started taking some plant biology classes, and I massively fell in love with the plants. Like, so the plants ended up becoming my niche at that time, and they still are now. I'd say that's probably my greatest strength and the thing that I teach about the most when I do my, my rewilding education classes is
nice.
Foraging herbals, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So then after that, you know, it works seasonally, you know, there's in the field of outdoor and environmental education,
yeah.
work and moving around, everything I own fit in my car and just go from one park to the other, to an outdoor education center, to another park. And
it's the nature of the business.
It was the nature of the business. And I
ski
loved it.
Ski in the winter. And
I loved it. Yep. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. Meet a lot of people. It was great. I ended up landing a job at a humane society out here in Colorado, and I ended up beginning the humane and environmental education program at that humane society at that time, which was another dream come true because I really wanted to start and run a program on my own.
Yeah.
So I did that, and of course I'm working in with animals, and I'm working in animal welfare, and that's tough.
Yeah,
it's really, really tough. And I started just really questioning all kinds of things. And just coincidentally, I started my own therapeutic process personally during that time. And so those were parallel to each other. And then I started matching. I'm like, oh, like maybe people will care for the land and care for animals and abuse less and be more empathetic if they can connect differently and be in relationship differently and heal their wounds. So I started putting that together in my head, and I woke up one day and I never actually really thought about it before, but then some intuitional voice was like, go to school for counseling, go to grad school for counseling. And I was like, I like animals way more than people. I'm like, I know it's needed. And so I had this little inner debate with my intuition, but I followed instructions and I did research and I applied. And I think within like 3 weeks, I was in a graduate school program in counseling at CSU. So
amazing how fast that happens when you get an answer from the universe. It's like,
answer,
bam.
You got it. And I think that was a really important step for me, was to listen to that. And for the ease that followed after that was information. Like, that was a feedback loop for me. I was like, oh, even if it may not be my first idea or my first thought, when you hear that voice, follow through.
Yeah.
Definitely. And good things happen. So I did. And it was interesting. I mean, a lot of people that I was going to school with in the graduate school, you know, we introduce ourselves as a cohort, you know, this process, and everyone had already dipped their toes in the mental health field. Either they worked in, like even as an admin assistant in mental health organizations, or they had worked for another therapist doing some side work, or they had worked as a milieu counselor. You know, there was a number of avenues that they had already worked. And then it was time for me to introduce myself. And I'm like, I teach people about raccoons and trees. And they all kind of looked at me a little weird, but I knew that I was still on the right track.
Yeah.
And so I took the raccoons and the trees into my counseling program, meaning every project, every research, everything I did was about integrating nature and wilderness into the therapeutic process. So I was just doing that on my own.
And now at this time, you know, I don't know when this was I don't suppose ecotherapy as we know it now was like a thing, because you said that it kind of wasn't. Was there any, I mean, what was going on at that time in the field? And like, were you kind of coming in as these things were becoming known more?
Yes. Okay. I just didn't know about them.
I see.
I knew that wilderness therapy was a thing.
Right, so, with Nalls and things like that.
Yes. And I knew that there was that intervention-based, long-term, backcountry for groups of people experience.
Yeah.
I knew that that was out there.
Which is not a model for everyone.
Which is not a model for everyone, right? Right. I did a lot of research on it because that was what was primarily available.
Yeah.
And as I was, you know, I'd write about it and I'd read about it, and I knew in my heart that that wasn't the path for me, but I was like, this is the closest thing that I can actually find right now,
right,
that at least ties these two worlds together, that ties ecology and psychology together. So I kind of went with it. Ecotherapy was a thing at that time. It just had not emerged into the mainstream yet. This was just about 12 years ago. I mean, really, it's probably as a formal field about 25 years old.
Right.
So there was people doing research. There was people writing books. There were people doing this. It was just such a small, there were such small pockets in the country and around the world, and it just wasn't in my purview.
Right.
So I was like, okay. So then from my point of view, I was like, okay, I'll figure this out on my own and I'll make it up and I'll figure it out. I will figure out how to blend nature connection and counseling with people.
Right.
So it wasn't that it didn't exist. I just didn't know that it didn't exist. And of course it's much more prevalent now. And sometimes I can't tell if it's just because I'm always looking for it that I find it a lot more now. I'm like, does everybody else know how big this is growing? You know, I don't know what people know. I'm just surrounded by it all the time. So I get a little biased, I guess, but it's definitely a very growing, developing field. And I think both practitioners and clients are ready to evolve into more experiential dynamic work.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Now you talked about your own personal therapeutic journey. And I wonder if you feel comfortable enough talking about that. Like, what did that look like for you as someone who, you know, maybe didn't have a background in therapy at that point, but definitely had a background in nature connection and that kind of stuff. What kinds of things were you incorporating into your life to help with whatever it is you were dealing with at the time?
Sure. While it sounds so simplistic and it sounds funny to say it out loud right now, I realized through that therapy, I mean, I feel like I'm a little bit of a naive, pure individual. And I went into it, and I say that it's like my disclaimer. I, for the first time, began to make the connection that my past affects who I am. Like, it was literally that simple. I didn't know, you know, we just live our lives.
Right.
We do things that our parents do, and we just respond and we react and we just do the next thing. A lot of people don't, but a lot of people do. Right. And that's how a lot of people operate, is we don't really live life consciously and don't live life with the consideration of like, oh, I wonder what's causing this reaction right now. I wonder what's causing, you know, my relationship struggles right now. You know, where did I learn this pattern way of being? Like, I never asked those questions. I just was.
Was it just kind of an epiphany out of nowhere? Or was there a moment that kind of brought you to that point, or a situation or something?
Well, I think just really after just a couple of therapy sessions, I was just like, oh, so you're asking me all these questions about this because you think it has to do with now. Like,
right, right.
And again, it sounds funny to say it now because it's like, well, of course. But at some point that I didn't know.
Right. And none of us do until we get to that point.
You don't know until you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, and of course, I mean, there was a lot more to that, but that simple piece just kind of blew my mind. and it also helped me to be more compassionate toward myself. And it also helped me to try to look further and bigger at the people that were causing the things that I was observing in all my animal welfare work.
Right.
Like I would see them instead of just being a jerk or a bad person. I'm like, there's something else going on.
Right. There's something behind that.
Something behind that. And so I think it led me to slow down a little bit and to slow the judgments down and to take another look and to ask more questions. And so it didn't just help me in my relationship with myself. It started to help me in my relationship with others. And especially we're coming from an animal welfare, animal rights concentration that I had in my personal life as well. I needed that. I do hold kind of a cynical piece a lot. And I still feel like that's a constant ongoing personal work for myself, is to judge less and not be so reactive to a lot of the abuse and the neglect and the everything that's happening to our planet, to the animals, to children, to one another. That's hard for me sometimes. And so that's a constant practice of going, there's a reason for this. And how can we examine what's happening from a larger, more compassionate lens instead of a reactive, judgmental, punishment lens? And so that has been really instrumental in my work with people, my work with animals, and my work with myself. And it all just seemed to fit together.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. I realized one day that I'm not just doing ecotherapy because nature heals. I'm doing nature-based and ecotherapy because the divorcement from nature harms. And those are two different things.
Tell me more about that, because and let's kind of thread that into this term rewilding that, you know, that we see a lot on your website and that we hear a lot these days, you know, because I think they're related, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, in all of my work and in all my studies with animals and nature-based stuff and doing environmental and outdoor education, I did naturally become curious. I'm curious about our history. So I became curious about our history of Homo sapiens and began to know, not on a deep level. I mean, I didn't go to school for anthropology or things like that, but doing a little bit of reading and research to at least have some level of context. I mean, everything happens in a context. I'm like, where is our current modern day situation? What context does that fit in? So in learning a little bit about that and learning about our history, learning about our Homo sapien history of hundreds of thousands of years of living sustainably and in relationship with the rest of the living world, and then our 5 to 6+ million-year history with our hominid ancestors living in sustainable relationships with the natural world, that it put what's happening now into a different context. And doing some of that research, you know, led me into, as well as actually doing some like ecological restoration work, led me to find the breath of rewilding stuff out there that was starting to come out a number of years ago. And it, like, literally the moment that I heard that word, I was like, that's it. And it took everything that I was interested in, you know, in learning about the self and other as human beings, and learning about Homo sapiens and our history with the natural world, and in learning about animals and in learning about the, you know, everything from herbalism and tracking, how it all is just a big web of interconnectedness. And what we do right now started to make sense in how we live in given the context of what we're actually removed from right now. Because how we live right now, which to most people that are just living their daily life, right, they don't know the context that they're in.
Yeah, just seems like normal. Like
it's just normal.
This is how it is.
We just live inside all day and we're in front of screens all day and we interact in our relationships through screens. Like this is just normal. And people, you don't, again, you don't know what you don't know. And so anyway, I started wanting to take all of these pieces and do something with them. And I couldn't find anybody that was blending all of these pieces. Like nobody's doing this. Nobody's blending the therapy and the environmental education and the nature connection and the context of our historical relationship with the natural world. Like nobody was doing that, at least that I could find. I was like, all right, I'll do it myself. So, and that's when I started relational rewilding nature guiding. And that became my umbrella essentially for facilitating nature connection and nature education classes, because I still do that. I love teaching. And so I do workshops and I teach for Denver Botanic Gardens and Audubon societies, and I put my own classes out. And I do that piece and I love that piece. And now's the season for that to happen. That slows down a lot in the winter.
Yeah.
But it's also the umbrella under which I do the nature-based therapy, where I can actually integrate some of those pieces into the therapeutic work. So even though it's called nature guiding, I just put it all under one. And really the rewilding piece ends up becoming a question mark for people, which ends up instigating dialogue. And that's what I really like. They're like, oh, what is rewilding? And I'm like, have a seat. Here's a cup of tea.
Yeah.
It is. It's juicy and it's kind of an upcoming thing. There's so many components and aspects to it. And people have their own part of it. You know, I don't have to do every single part of what rewilding means. And nobody can do everything. And, you know, my part is helping to do some nature connection work. And I like to blend the nature education and the nature connection work together in my programs. I don't just disseminate information. People can find that on apps now, you know, I encourage people to have encounters and experiences with beings before we actually learn the technical knowledge about them. And then also, how do I blend that and get creative with that in the therapeutic world? And it's, you know, I don't have children. And I think having children is such a, it's like the ultimate creation. And
yes.
As you know, I mean, you can't top that creation wise. But I still consider myself to be creative.
Of course.
Feel like that creativity in my own body and in my system and in my heart and in my head just gets redirected toward all of these fields and putting them together. And it's constant. Like I'm like, oh, what kind of program can I do? And how different would I do that? And
yeah.
What bring in and like, who could I collaborate with? And I mean, and so that's my creativity is programs. Yeah. And how can I work with clients in new and different ways, given what their presenting concern is and what it is that they're working through? So it is very creative.
Yeah. Process. Yeah. I mean, every encounter is a custom encounter.
Yeah. You can't put this in a protocol.
Nope. And it wouldn't work if you tried.
It wouldn't work if you tried.
Exactly. Yeah. At least it wouldn't work as well. That's for sure. And then that's, you know, for me, the beauty of this kind of work is that, you know, there is a huge part of that being creative piece and being a skilled facilitator in that way. And the beauty of it is that half the work we don't have to do.
Because
the natural world does it for us.
And yeah, it's funny you say that. I mean, from a therapeutic perspective, a lot of times, depending on kind of what your initial modality is, mm-hmm. a lot of the work, especially in working with individuals, is the relationship between the therapist and the client. Right. Like that is the primary relationship that you're really needing to build. So then you can have that as a solid foundation to explore everything else. When you're doing family therapy, as a therapist, your focus is not on creating a strong relationship between the therapist and the clients. It's on facilitating relationship between the family members. Mm, so it's different. Yeah. So then, like, as you were saying, for me, even if I'm working with individuals, but I'm outside and I'm either working with our horses and I'm working with the birds and I'm working with the trees and I'm working with the elements and I'm working with whatever's happening in the present moment, it's less about my relationship with the client and more about me facilitating relationship between them and everything that's going on. Mm. So I'm more of a facilitator of relationship that's partnering and collaborating with all of the elements and the beings and the animals and the horses, rather than making me a focus. Like, I'm not here to dispel the wisdom. I'm here to point out your own dynamic and interaction and relational potential between yeah. you and all of these other beings. So that is the focus. I'm like, you have to find this for yourself, and I'm going to help you find this. So when you walk away from here, that's yours and you can take that anywhere.
Yeah.
I always say, like, whether I'm in environmental education, whether I'm in humane education, whether I'm in conservation work or therapeutic work, I want to be out of a job.
Right.
I want to
That's
not
the ultimate goal.
Ultimate goal. And like, I love this stuff, but I'm doing it because the world needs it. Right. I wish the world didn't need these kinds of things that we do. But my ultimate goal would be to be out of a job. Until then,
right.
I want to help other people to make contact and relationship in new and different ways that are more in alignment with how we're designed to be in contact and relationship.
That brings to mind the idea that nature is a mirror for us. It mm-hmm. mirrors back to us, you know, what is in ourselves if we're, you know, present and awake and aware enough to see it. Do you have any stories that you can relate on that? That maybe with clients? I don't know if you're able to share that kind of stuff or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, in some general sense.
Sure, yeah.
So I think nature and animals, and really, to be honest, anything and anyone.
Because we are all nature.
Because we're all nature, right? It has a ability to reflect us, right? And we are, as human beings with the beautiful, complex minds that we have and how we've also learned to think, we have a incredible tendency, and we all do it, to project.
Right.
And to project onto, especially onto beings that often don't talk back.
Mm. You know? Yeah, because it's easier that way.
It's easier that way. And so a lot of projection happens in the therapeutic world, and that's always something that's one of the many things that we're paying attention to, because projection is one way that we break contact and relationship with others. It stops connection.
Right. It creates disconnection and discord.
Yes. So for example, I was actually just sharing with somebody today, I have a number of examples of this, but when I'm working with people and I may be out in a park, and I was, this is actually when I was working up in Fort Collins, and, you know, I teach bird language. And so I'm constantly paying attention to the birds and the bird language of what's happening whenever I'm out, especially with other people. And I work with that with people because, mm-hmm. I mean, the birds are always giving us information about what's going on in their world and what's happening in the world around us.
Right.
when I'm out with a client and, like, for example, I remember we were kind of walking on this trail together and there was a bird. It was a number of years ago. I'm trying to remember what kind, but this bird kind of came out of one side of the trail, crossed the trail and was walking really fast. And I think maybe, you know, we had moved, actually, I'm not sure what was going on. So the bird head was walking really fast across the trail and the client kind of stopped and was like, oh my gosh, he's so scared. And I was like, maybe. I was like, let's just pause here for a few minutes and let's just keep watching him.
Yeah.
And so we just went into this observation state of really building awareness and trying to gather more information. Because like I said before, everything happens in a context. So when a bird walks across the trail, there's a context for that.
Right.
Our human tendency is to take one simple event or word, or somebody smiled at me, or somebody didn't smile at me, or somebody said something in a way that I didn't like it, or the, you know, we take these individual pieces of an interaction and we project some sort of interpretation onto it without actually zooming back and observing and taking in the whole.
Right.
And so we would just sit there on the trail and we would observe the bird. So the bird would go across and was kind of nipping at the ground and was doing some feeding. And then it was like 4 minutes later or something. And then the bird actually went up a little bit and then crossed the trail again. And we ended up watching this bird for about 10 minutes. And it's like, oh, actually the bird just moves this way. And so there was some new information that the client was getting. It's just like, and I would ask a question again. I'm like, so we just observed this. So I was kind of using like a scientific mind. I'm like, this is what we observed, and this is what we observed, and this is what we observed. So looking at this again, do you think that the bird was scared? It's like, no, actually, I just think that's how he walks. I'm like, yeah, I think that's how he walks too. I'm like, you know, do you walk fast when you're scared? You know, or do you feel scared in your life? And then we kind of start moving into those little pieces. It's like, where did that come from? And I know that's like a really oversimplification. I mean, I have horses here and we work with horses and a lot of projection goes onto the horses, right? And I actually had a client up here today and we would go up to the horse and we would start interacting and start talking and start grooming. And my little horse, little spirit, and she would keep walking away. And she's like, oh, she doesn't like me. And so, I mean, that kind of stuff comes up all the time. And so let's just pause and let's just watch little spirit for a little while. And let's just see what she's doing. It's like, oh, actually she just went over there because she wanted some food. She just wanted to eat.
Right.
And so we are constantly doing this. And we do this with one another. And so being able to take those types of tendencies, and I can see those, and we always make sure to work with them and do like a complete circle. Like I don't leave a projection out there unattended. So we always want to make sure that we correct that. And then we take a look back at the client and to see, you know, how and where is this happening in your life, or, you know, where did that come from?
Yeah.
I like there to be, I want the relationship between the client and the animal, or the client and the tree, or the client and the nature, whatever, you know, whoever it is that we're working with. I want that to end when we leave. It's going to be clean.
Yeah.
They're going to have a more clear, truthful understanding because they have taken in more information with their senses versus just seeing one quick piece and putting an explanation and interpretation on it that was really just fed by their own inner world.
Right.
So I'm pretty careful with them leaving with a cleanliness between the horses and the nature.
Yeah. And you kept saying it's very simple, and it is, but it's so profound and so powerful because, like you keep saying, and it's so true, we all do this all the time, every day, but we're so stuck in that mode of thinking. Mm-hmm. That we don't see it. We don't notice it. It's so subtle for us that it's just the way the world is. It you know, but when you have someone on the outside, such as yourself, a therapist, to bring things like that to our attention. Mm-hmm. And not only to bring it to our attention that moment, but to teach us how to bring it to our own attention in the future.
Yes.
That's where the power is, because yes, that's where lasting change can happen in my mind. That's where, you know, now, and that's the beauty of the natural world, is because, you know, I mean, everyone in relationships and everything, we encounter these situations. I feel like the natural world is probably more of a socially safe place to be mm-hmm. able to do this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Because I hesitate to say that there aren't consequences for our projections on the natural world, because there certainly are, but I might maybe I could say that they're not as immediate as our projections with others can be. And so perhaps that's a good place to take, you know, our issues, so to speak, and work on them. I mean, we should be doing that all day, every day.
But we don't.
Looking within, but we don't.
but we just live our lives.
Exactly. But awesome tools like this and amazing people like yourself that can bring these things to our awareness, it's just so powerful. And just helps us live better.
You can't change and you can't make choice about something you're not aware of. Hmm. And when we're behaving in a way that's automatic and in response to something within us or something in our past, usually it's not conscious.
Right.
And if it's not a conscious reaction, that means that you're not making a choice about it.
Right.
And so in bringing awareness and therapists like myself, and there's many other amazing ecotherapists, relational therapists, gestalt therapists that are doing this work, us reflecting other people's perceptions back to them and helping them to become aware and then investigating other choices helps to give them choice, and choice equals health.
Right.
And so, yeah, you can't make a healthy choice if you're not even aware of the choice that you're making now. You can't make another choice. So I was working with a young woman. She was about 20 years old. Her presenting concern was eating disorders, and they were pretty significant. Very nice, sweet young woman, and very caring. And she loved nature and animals. And she was open at the time to doing outdoor work. She had been through many therapists and inpatient programs before. And I had introduced this to her, and she was very open to it. And so, I mean, I ended up working with her for about a year and a half, and everything that we did was outdoors.
Nice.
But toward the beginning of our sessions together, I had asked her to meet me at a site that was by a river, and she was sitting down on the river's edge, and I joined her. And so we were sitting there, and typically I will do like some sort of brief intro sensory grounding practice at the beginning of a session before jumping into content. And we had done that, and we were in the check-in stage of the session, just seeing what was happening for her at that time and before we get into her her content. Where we were sitting, there was large cottonwood trees overhanging the river. It was a beautiful day, blue sky. I believe it was late spring. Cottonwood trees overhanging. The river was flowing. The river was about 3 feet high or so. And as we were sitting there, a little bit upstream from us, there was a bird nest. And this was fledgling season. We were observing as we were chatting, and we had noticed that one of the fledglings from a nest that was in a cottonwood branch above the river, and the fledgling fell out of the nest and fell into the river. And it was very klutzy. It was not graceful. It was not on purpose. And the bird was struggling in the water and was he was flapping his wings and just seemed to be going into his own panic state. And all of this happened so fast. My client and I looked at each other. We stopped immediately. We looked at each other and we almost gave each other the silent consent. And both of us jumped in the river. And as the bird was, I mean, again, the river was flowing. So the bird was actually coming down the center of the river and we had to get in the 3-foot river and go across in order to try and catch the bird. So she actually went out ahead of me. I was actually there more for safety reasons. Like I was kind of right behind her with my hands around near her. And she went out and she scooped up the struggling bird. And then I asked her if I could touch her arm and she said yes. And so I was holding her arm just so she could keep balance. And we walked together with the bird in our hand back toward the shore. We put the bird just barely up on the shore in between some grasses and both of us are soaked and we had a good laugh for a little bit and took a couple deep breaths of relief and just feeling really good about that. And then we sat back on the shore and again, we just sat there and we didn't really say anything for about a minute and we looked at one another and I had asked her, I was like, how was that for you? And what did you notice? And she was like, I got really scared and I just suddenly this bird just seemed to fall out of the sky and he was struggling and it really scared me for him. And I said, what was that bird doing? And she was like, he was panicking. And I was like, yeah, the bird is panicking. I said, the other thing that I saw was that this bird was fighting for his life. Yeah. And I said, when are you going to start fighting for yours? And she just, and like, that was it. I mean, we were 25 minutes into a session and she just started tearing up and she knew exactly what I was referring to.
Yeah.
And that day and that occurrence and that statement ended up becoming an opening for almost every single one of our sessions where so frequently I would ask her, we would refer back to that moment and we would refer back to the energy and the innate vitality that we have to survive and to protect ourselves and to fight for our life. And so that became a question and content for us almost every session of what did you do this week in order to fight for your life? And where we went with that is in a million different directions and how that showed up in her life every single day. Yeah. And regardless of whether it was her occupying herself through menial things, trying to not throw up her lunch. Or whether that was working with the voices in her head. And again, maybe calling somebody to actually speak with a human being instead of engaging in a conversation with a voice in her head that told her to not eat. And so it just became this catalyst and this pathway for so many conversations. And she also, that bird became an ally for her.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and sometimes when she would struggle and she's just like, nope, I really struggled and I feel like I failed this week. And I'm like, okay, what would the bird do? How would the bird protect himself? How would the bird fight for his life? And how do we re-engage the spirit of life that runs through you, that runs through the birds? And then we would also, of course, since we were literally outside every single session, we were constantly observing birds and wildlife and amphibians and reptiles almost every single behavior that we would watch of them was them doing something to save or protect or promote or fight for their life. Yeah. And so I was directing her perception and her vision to what life is calling us to do, because it's everywhere.
Yeah.
That desire to survive and to fight and to protect and to live is so innate in every single one of us, human animals, as well as non-human animals. And so we were able to see that every single week when I saw her, and we had 3-hour sessions. Every session was a 3-hour session. So we had a lot of time to work through some of these pieces. So that was really impactful for me in playing with and working with the spontaneity that nature brings.
Yeah.
And the creativity of how would I relate this occurrence to the relationship that's happening between whatever happened in the client and also whatever is happening in the client's world, inner world, outer world, whatever that may be. Hmm. It was really powerful. And I am happy to say that about a year and a half later, she actually, it was probably about a year after that, we did a lot of archery together. That was actually one of our primary pieces. Nice. That we did together. And she had went out and purchased a bow, which I actually helped her. I actually went to the store with her to go do that.
Perfect.
She had purchased a bow and she had started practicing archery about every week or every other week. And I had shown her where to go. And after I had actually stopped seeing her, because she was doing better, I think like a month after, she had texted me a photograph of her holding her bow in the site where we used to work. And she was like, look at me now. And obviously it took much more than one bird session, but it was just a really telling aspect. And it was a turning point in our work together.
That's amazing how that instance, that occurrence in the natural world, like became an anchor
for
kind of framed everything that she was trying to accomplish and overcome.
Exactly. Yeah. Anchor is a good word for it, because we did keep coming back to it, and it ended up directing our lens and how we looked at the natural world from that point, which helped her really see herself as an animal as well.
Yeah.
Well, designed to protect herself.
Absolutely. And I think the piece that brought that all together, of course, was your skill as a mentor and a facilitator to take advantage of that opportunity and to connect that.
Yes.
So that's huge. That's huge.
And that piece is very much helped by my exposure and my time in nature.
Right.
If I just wanted to relocate my sessions outdoors, but I didn't spend much time out there, if I didn't have my own nature connection practices, if my awareness wasn't on, if my creativity wasn't sparked by nature, I may not have made a connection between that event and essentially the core of what was happening in her life.
Right.
And so nature to me, and I think you and everybody else that spends time in nature knows that nature just promotes creativity. And so the more time I spend out there, I feel like it feeds my ability to make those connections and to see the webs between us and the living world. And
right.
So everything that happens ends up becoming transferable back into the person's life.
Perfect. Yeah, totally. That's cool. That's a fun story.
Yeah, it was really cool. And that's it. I just, you know, after I spoke with you and I was like, that's a very good example of what happens out in the field with people when you're open to not just relocating outside, but actually collaborating with anything and everything that happens in your surroundings.
Yeah. Well, and the beauty of that story, you know, beyond what it meant for her and you as a practitioner, is those are the kinds of stories that people hear and that, you know, that we could tell through mediums like this. And it can be powerful for them too, you know, because many of us have had moments where we've seen an animal struggle for its life for whatever reason, you know, and so,
can't make a different choice.
Right. Yeah. And it's just a really hard thing to pick apart. it's so hard to pick apart one's own brain. And but this is a fun conversation, and these are very neat principles, because personally, I just finished reading Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Amazing book. And all these principles are in there, and they talk about that. Yeah. And, you know, you don't universal. Sometimes, it's so universal. And you see it in just about every healing modality, you know, for psychological healing, just presented in different ways.
Yes.
And it's just so amazing that the natural world has such power to bring that to our awareness if we know how to see it, if we know how to allow it. And that's the beauty of the arts, the awareness arts, such as bird language and tracking and all that, and naturalist skills studies in general, because we start to see things that we knew weren't there before, or at least they were there. We just didn't see them.
We just didn't see them.
Yeah. And so when you do that, it's like that bird that has always been there, but you didn't know. And then finally you learned that bird's name and what it is. And now you see it all over the place.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like that's what happens in the mind when we go through those kinds of things as well. Like, oh, I do that. Oh, I do that a lot. Oh, right. I should probably not do that anymore. So.
And that's part of this gift of, you know, like you're saying, of working with nature and working with all of those means of nature connection and the application of it therapeutically. You know, it's like a big, you know, a question I'm always asking, and how I work with other therapists, and I help teach other therapists also how to do this. And
right.
And it's like, how do we work with animal tracking and plants and bird language and those such nature connection means in a therapeutic manner? And to me, there's such a gateway, not just to learning about the natural world, but there's such a gateway to learning about ourselves. Mm. And, you know, I actually just taught a plant class. It was an online plant class. Right. I couldn't quite go outside with people yet.
For those listening in the future, we're in the middle of the COVID-19 lockdown.
Here, yes. So. Yes. So we're doing environmental lessons inside on the computer.
Right.
It's also a gift. I am very grateful. But one of the pieces that I was emphasizing, and I think you're familiar with this concept as well, is that when I am teaching about plants, is that we're developing search images in our brain. So I have people take time on a sensory level and on a felt sense level to engage with plants. And I have questions that are drawing out their curiosity and are drawing out them interacting with the plants on a multi-sensory level.
Right.
As they do that, they're creating search images in their mind for that plant. So now when they go out, instead of just seeing 1,000 plants, they now have a search image for that one. So they may not know the name and the uses and, you know, all of that piece, but suddenly that plant is an individual that they've had an encounter with. Hmm. And they're like, oh, hi, what's up?
Right.
And so I'll create, quote, like a search image. And so I'll work with, like, for example, like one of the kiddos that I work with, is that we do a lot of outer tracking and we do a lot of landscape mapping.
Hmm.
And so, you know, we'll spend a couple of sessions or the first half of many sessions of essentially tracking the outer landscape. And we have fun doing it. Like,
yeah.
Fun. Like, we get on the grounds and we're like, how does the fox move? And how do we do this? And then, you know, we'll draw maps of them and, you know, we'll marking. And so they're kind of getting this topography lens of their landscape, and we're listening and we're putting in significant areas and all of that piece. So we do this whole piece and we'll spend that and do a whole session. And then I have them go home and I'm like, you know, now I want you to do like a landscape map of your neighborhood and of your house and, you know, those kinds of things. Then the next session, she comes back and then we kind of review, we talk about that and how fun it is. And we, you know, look for tracks again. And I'm like, and now today we're going to talk about tracking inside. And so now she already has kind of her own search image.
Yeah.
Of how we track and how we pay attention to landscapes. And so now she's applying that to her inner nature as well as to the outer nature. And then of course there's a million directions that we, that we go with that, but especially when working with kids, I think it's really important to give them, again, kind of a context and a framework or a search image of, because going inside is weird, you know?
Yeah.
What? But we do want to start planting those roots and, you know, helping people to be able to navigate themselves and know what's happening in themselves. Right. But just telling, you know, a 10 or 11 year old to go inside and tell me how you feel, I mean, that's not going to work. Talk therapy, I don't find, works indoors with young people.
Hmm.
Oftentimes I don't actually find it works indoors with adults either, but especially with kiddos, for sure.
Right, right. What an amazing gift, though. I mean, as a young person, to have had those kinds of seeds planted and ideas in my head going forward, life would have been a lot easier if I had some kind of, you know, mental plan of, you know, navigating life. Mm-hmm. And what better than a map of the internal landscape, or even just the concept of that, you know, and how fulfilling that could be growing up and being able to use that tool and not wait till I was 25 or 30 to figure it out, you know?
Yeah, I think I was like 32.
Yeah.
And I do. I'm like, gosh, I wish I had me when I was 10.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the beauty of this work. Yeah, and that's the beauty of this work too, is, I mean, part of it is, you know, at least in my experience, going back to that young Ron in my case and like kind of mentoring him and saying, look, you know, this is why you did that and we're thinking this way and it's okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a really powerful and profound healing that happens for me now when I'm able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Because you're going back with so much more compassion. And you're going in with this big picture, holistic context of which everything that you do and have done fits into. And suddenly it's like, oh, that makes sense.
Right.
I get why that happened. And I get why I did that. And I get why I responded that way. And then that awareness provides the opportunity for choice.
Right. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you see... What are some, and I think we kind of touched on a little bit, but what do you see are kind of some of the main differences between working with adults and working with kids in these ways with ecotherapy?
Adults can think and talk abstractly more. So, to be honest, I will do the same things.
Mm.
I'll do the same things that are experiential, that are relational, that are systemic. But what I will end up doing is, you know, usually toward then the end of a session, for example, then we can talk about the experience in a way that is has a little bit more of a maturity to it and an abstract reflection to it that some of the kiddos may not be able to do.
Right.
But really, I mean, I do the same things.
That's perfect.
Yeah. And one, because one is all of us are missing this. Yeah. I don't care what age, we're all missing it. There's divorcement and separation, and we are all swimming in water that is colored. I'm being thoughtful here.
right. Take your time.
Yeah. The water that we swim in is colored with rules and messages and interjects that we are unaware of. Hmm. And that happens for both children and adults. we are all socialized in certain ways, and most of us are not aware of that. So all of those are helping to feed and help us understand to learn why we're doing what we're doing. But in working with kids, so I'm doing experiential pieces with both, and we both need to heal this divorcement and this separation that we have with the natural world. And again, because like I said, that divorcement actually creates harm. Yeah. It's not just that doing it is good. I mean, one thing I always like to mention, not correct, but the whole nature in kids seems to be a theme. And I love it and I appreciate it and I encourage it and I want that. But nature is not a hobby for children. Yes. Nature is who we are from conception through death
and beyond it,
everything.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so everyone's just like, oh, well, I'll do it this way. But my kid loves nature. And so she'll do the nature therapy. And I'm like, I appreciate that. And this
you
is
want,
something
you want some nature therapy too.
Exactly. And luckily, you know, when I do work with kids, I usually have a couple of sessions with the parents and I bring them up and part of it is me showing them, I'm like, you know, this is what's happening. I want right. them to know. I like to be completely transparent.
Right. Yeah.
Parent about like, this is what we're doing. This is what I'm working on. And your child may come home and they may describe that we just played.
Mm-hmm.
But I want you to know that there is nothing that we do that is not intentional.
Right.
Everything yeah. we do has a function. So they just think that we're imitating Fox and that we're crawling on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I'm going, okay, this is the outer landscape that we're tracking, which is going to help us track the inner landscape. So like everything right. has a function. Everything has a purpose. And to be honest, it is the same with adults. And also just because an adult walks in the door and let's say I get somebody that's 45 that's coming to me, developmentally, they may be stuck at 12.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's another piece that we need to consider and be looking out for and listening for in language and those kind of pieces. And so if I'm meeting somebody that's 12 and I'm talking to them like they're 45, we're going to miss each other.
Right.
And to be honest, we're all kind of stuck in younger ages.
Yeah. We're all stuck somewhere.
We're all stuck somewhere. And, you know, of course that goes back to another whole conversation of
right.
maturity and how we are raised and no rituals and ceremonies and rites of passage and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah.
So we're all stuck and myself included, all the therapists that are amazing are all stuck. I mean, it's not a judgment. It's just what happens.
Yeah. It's the nature. It's what is. I mean, just, we all, if you live in this world, you've been wounded in some way, you know, yeah. and we're all dealing with that in, mm-hmm. in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the big message is that nature can be a huge part of that healing.
Yes.
And should be, because it's who we are. It's, yes. you know, it's that part of going within and all that.
And the part of going within and also touching in with children and nature, a really important piece. And I will sometimes, again, I'll do this with adults and children, is I'm like, we're going to play today. Play is very much missing from our society. Kids are growing up faster. They're learning about things that they shouldn't be learning about yet. They're seeing things that they shouldn't be seeing yet.
Yep.
All of that piece. And so a lot of my work is I'm like, I'm trying to get little kiddos out of their head and out of their thinking and out of their stress. I'm like, how can you be 12 today instead of a 12-year-old trying to be 35, trying to solve all of the problems of the world? I'm like, that's not your job. Your job is to play and to develop connection with the world right now. And that's what we're going to do. And so some days we just play and there's a function to the play.
Yeah.
And it's really rewarding to participate. I mean, to see a kid be free and to be their age is so awesome.
Yeah.
And that's
I think our culture really underestimates play. as the vehicle for becoming a fully realized human being.
Amen. Yeah, totally.
So important. So important.
Being on time to 12 soccer practices a week with drills and like, to me, that's not what I mean by play.
Right. And video games is not what I mean by play.
What I mean. Exactly. Yeah.
And that, so those things have their place for sure. But
they do. Yes, they absolutely do. But they don't. Yeah. Play is different.
Right.
And I consider play to be a primary satisfaction that is one of the many primary satisfactions that isn't fulfilled in our life and that we end up compensating for by having secondary satisfactions.
Yep.
I was like, well, we're not playing because our parents don't want us to go outside. So now we're going to be inside of video games, which is a secondary satisfaction. And that never leads to deep fulfillment.
No.
I'm sorry. You can play video games and I'm not against them. You cannot tell me that your heart and your soul are deeply fulfilled and your life is fulfilled from video games.
Right.
But when you have a deep relationship with nature and the whole of the living community, you are full.
Yeah.
And you're engaging in it's just a completely different.
Well, now that we're talking about it, I think about it, you know, there's these wonderful, beautiful components of play, you know, creativity, spontaneity, energy and being energized and energetic. And when you look at the adults in, you know, the modern, postmodern Western world, whatever you want to call it, a lot of those things are lacking, mm-hmm. you know, in our lives. And it makes me wonder if even us who did have a lot more play, you know, us older adults who did have a lot more play in our lives than a lot of the kids growing up today do. If we're lacking that, maybe because of a lack in the past, what are the kids in 20 years going to look like? What are their lives going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
And it saddens me to ponder that.
Yes.
And we can reincorporate that in our lives, even as adults. That's the beauty of it. Yeah. And I think nature is the perfect playground to facilitate that, you know, whatever that play might look like for someone, you know, whether it's whatever, you know, getting out and exploring, hiking, backpacking, rock climbing, you know, all these things. And at the same time, making sure that nature's not just the wallpaper for those activities, but it's part of the reason we're out, you know, to connect with the beings out there and all that. And the other component of that is that being a model for our kids who then see that and say, oh, or, you know, come along with us and all that. And yeah, how powerful could that be?
Yeah, I think this, I mean, I admit, and I possibly some adults can resonate with this, play can be scary.
Yeah.
Right. I remember I was actually a number of years ago, I was up at Wilderness Awareness School and I was doing a coyote mentoring workshop, and I remember the instructors coming out and they're like, today we're going to play. And I remember shutting down.
Yeah. I'm with you there.
Yeah.
You're not alone.
I was like, what is happening? I was like, what is going on? Like, I just wanted to like go in the corner and pull up book, curl up and be by myself. I'm like, you all go play. Right. I'm going to go be in my intellect and be by myself. And it was like, I didn't want anything to do with it. And I was just like, but I was aware of it. I was aware of the reaction and I was like, I want to make a different choice. And I remember so I actually raised my hand and I was like, I have to admit that this is kind of freaking me out. like I don't want to play. And like, play is vulnerable because you're just free. And I'm like, I prefer to be like in control and yada yada.
Right. Right.
And they're, you know, I mean, of course they were awesome. And they're just like, cool. We'll just, you know, kind of, we'll experiment with it today and we'll see what happens. And so me just putting it out there and just naming it in front of everyone and like everyone kind of on their own took to helping me relax and to have fun. And actually one of the instructors, she had, a My Little Pony, like those little toys.
Right.
Actually when I grew up, And she handed me this and she was like, you have to carry this around all day. And this is going to remind you about play. This is, it's just your friendly little reminder, and you get to carry around My Little Pony.
That's awesome.
It was really cool. And so I carried around My Little Pony all day long.
And you're a horse lover too. So that's perfect.
And I'm a horse lover too. And so, but doing that made me laugh, and laughter was like the first little wall, right? Like, cause I was there to learn, you know, I was there to get my outline of learning things and what I can do with kids and how I can teach them to play, right?
Do some hardcore adulting.
Hardcore adulting, yeah. And so the My Little Pony just made me laugh, which kind of relaxed, and everyone laughed with me. And then I just kind of consciously was just like breathing all day, and I'm like, I can participate in this. And I did, and I had a blast. And that was a really significant day and lesson for me. And that it was vulnerable, but I was vulnerable with other people that were vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like vulnerable as in like, you know, we weren't like sharing our life stories, but being free and not maintaining like personal identity control is vulnerable.
Right. Yeah.
And laughing and running and moving your body in ways that people don't normally see move, and all of that, all of those things. So that was really, that was significant for me. Yeah. And so I think you're right. You know, a lot of adults, they don't play either. And I think some people may resonate with, with that, that it may feel vulnerable because we want to be in control and right or something. I don't know, but no,
it resonates with me for sure. I attended a coyote conference in California a few years back, and it was my first experience with other people that are into this kinds of stuff as well, you know, and you know, I kind of knew what to expect, but not really. And when I got there, you know, just pulling up before I even got there, I hear the music playing and I, you know, I get up and there's this big like deck area, you know, and all these people are just dancing, you know, just living life and loving it. And I'm like,
sounds like a nightmare sometimes.
This is cool. Well, I was like, at first I was like, this is cool. Cause I'm driving in my car. I'm not expected to do anything. Right.
Right.
And then I go and I park and I get there and now I'm with all these people. I'm like, ooh, do I have to dance?
Is it dance?
And it was very informal. So at that point it was like, no, I don't have to, but then I'm just like the chum sitting on the side watching everyone dance, you know?
Exactly.
So I totally relate with that.
Yes.
And, I will say I did dance a little bit, but I wouldn't say I let myself go like I should have.
Right.
I was much less aware of, yeah, yeah. So anyways, so yeah, I totally relate to that.
Yes, that story sounds familiar as well. Yeah, the whole dancing thing, that can really jar some people.
Yeah, and you know, because I feel like us in the United States, particularly, and perhaps other countries too, we didn't grow up in this culture and love of dancing. At least not all of it. Most of us, I would say. And so dancing is something that's a little bit foreign in many ways. You know, it's something that is, you know, not done as much this day and age.
Right.
And it's such a shame because anyone who has been able, whether they're by themselves or with other people, whatever, has been able to just let go and dance it out. Holy cow. What a release.
It's amazing. And
how fun. Seriously.
I know.
So yeah, that's it's kind of a shame. And it's an avenue that we can all work on a little bit, maybe.
Well, and whether it be dance or, I mean, so to me, one aspect of rewilding is movement, right?
Yeah,
and so, whether it's like technically dance, but I like doing imitations of animals, especially with adults, because they're so like against it.
Yeah. They're going to break out of the mind a little bit.
Right. Like, I'm not making you dance. But how does a bear walk? You know?
Be a fox.
Be a fox. How do you be a fox?
Right.
In, you know, creating openings for people to do that, to feel safe and comfortable.
Yeah.
It takes a certain kind of quality of energy and to give people space to do something that either they haven't done in a long time or something that they've never done and something that feels a little bit vulnerable and less controlled. And so, yeah, wild movement is a part of rewilding. So it's a part of the programs I teach and it's a part of, you know, some of the therapeutic work that I do and
right.
course, that helps develop empathy and all kinds of other fun stuff. But yeah, movement, I think, is incredibly important.
Very good.
And walking barefoot. I like.
Oh, yeah.
Get clients to take their shoes off, which I just did that last week, too. And that's a significant sensory-based movement piece as well. That feels vulnerable on our soft feet that don't touch the ground hardly anymore. So.
Right. Yep. So, you know, we've been talking about a lot of these different things, and I think they're things that people can incorporate. It'd be great if we could all have, you know, our own ecotherapists to lead and guide us. And unfortunately, of course, we know that that isn't the case for everyone. So what are some things that people can do to incorporate these ecotherapeutic principles into their lives? And particularly with kids, because as we know, there's a bit of a mental health crisis going on in the Western world in general among our youth. Lots of just really sad things going on there. What can we do for ourselves and for our kids to kind of lift this up a little bit and help ourselves with our own mental health?
Of course, you know, always the easy and quickest answer is spend time outside, and things are never as easy as, as they seem. Right. And I mean, I know it's a lot of people that work in this field, you know, will say, you know, spend time outside. And I actually think that people do spend more time outside than maybe they think, but I actually think people aren't aware of it. I want to stick to your question, but I actually think that it's less about needing to spend 4 hours a day outside and go camping every single weekend than it is about the quality of awareness that you have when you're there.
Yes.
One of my teachers, John Stokes, always, you know, one of the first things that he said in the first training I did is he was like, the quality of your awareness determines the quality of your life. And I reflect on that a lot still. And in modern day times, when we do have a lot going on and we like to fill our plates and we like to fill our kids' plates and all of those pieces, what if a piece of the work we do, I still encourage more time outdoors and I try to work with people on how to fit that into their life. And what if it's about the quality of our time? What if it's about the quality of awareness? What if it's about the quality of play? What if it's about the quality of attention? What if we're outside, you know, again, for example, it's like, if we're going to have dinner with our kids or with our family or with our partner, can we sit outside instead of inside? Right. And while we are outside, what is a different quality that we can bring to that? So we have the option of, even if we're sitting outside and it's a nice day or evening, that we can sit and talk about the dramas at work. We can talk about politics. We can talk about gossiping about somebody and somebody did something that we didn't like. And my mom said this and that, you know, we can choose to engage in that conversation,
right.
Or we can sit outside. And even if you just take 5 minutes of that time, like, we all need to download our day, of course. But what if we sit out here and what if we listen to the birds? What if we get curious? It's like, oh my gosh, did you hear him over there? Oh, look, you know, there's the robins over here. Oh, there's that chickadee. There's that nuthatch. And just to actually it's just a shift of focus.
Right.
That's all it is. And in doing that, I mean, so much happens. I mean, that's a catalyst. One is it ends up being a catalyst for new and different conversations.
Yeah.
Two, you're building a thread between yourself and any tree or being or bug or butterfly or whatever it is. You're forming a thread, a relationship between those two. You're shifting the quality of your mind. You're actually activating your parasympathetic nervous system when you're focusing on looking at a bird and observing their behavior and being curious about who they are and what they're doing and why they're doing it, what their worldview is.
Yeah.
You're going into your parasympathetic nervous system versus talking about politics, going into your sympathetic nervous system.
Right.
your brainwave shift. Like there's so many things that happen just with a very simple shift of quality of attention. So one is I would say focus a little bit on quality, like be consciously aware of where your mind goes and of the conversations that you're having. Mm-hmm. And yes, spend time. I mean, I think the quintessential practice of a lot of the people in our field is, you know, where's your sit spot? Can you sit on your porch once a day for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it is that you can do, and to create that relationship with that spot and with all of the beings and all of the elements that cross through that spot. And I encourage that kind of as quote homework, for people. Another thing of working with kiddos, I also noticed that some parents do spend time with their children, right?
Right.
I think parents want to spend more time with their children. Given life context and circumstances, that's always not possible, but parents still do spend time with children. So what are we doing during that time?
Right.
And again, in some people, they may go for a walk around the neighborhood. They may, if they're able to, if they have the capacity to, if they have the access, they may actually take their kids to some local park, maybe on the weekends or sometime when they have. And one thing that I observe, I love seeing families out in like neighborhood parks and in local parks. But something that I notice that happens, and it happens because it happened to us, and it's a part of a paradigm, is that we have to intellectualize everything for the children. So if a kid sees something and they become interested and curious or attracted and they start picking up a bug or they start looking at a flower or they're looking at a bird or they want to like follow a snake or something, we start labeling. We're like, oh, that's the snake and that's this. And we feel like we have to teach them. We've got to learn. We've got to fill their minds with facts. And instead, I encourage parents, like, actually just take a breath. You don't have to be on duty. You don't have to be teacher. Allow the children to just have an encounter and to have a connection and to be curious. Let them touch things. Let them move their body. All of those pieces. It's almost like less is more. Like, so my request would be for parents to do less. When you spend time with your children, except maybe asking them questions. Like if you see your kid drawn to something, what do you see? What are you interested? What do you think that they're doing? What do you think that bird is doing? Where do you think that bug lives? Like those types of things, but don't teach, don't label, don't intellectualize. Let them have an encounter. Let them have a sensory experience. That is our first language. Our first language is illiterate. Our first language is our bio language, which is having a felt sense experience with everything and everyone. That's first. It's always first. And unfortunately, in our drive to have good test scores, we take away the encounter and we take away the sensory experience and we replace it with the intellect. And to me, that's one of the saddest things that I see happen, is that parents have such good intentions and they want to do the stuff and they've actually packed a little backpack and they're going for a couple hours with their kids. And I can actually
maybe with a couple field guides in it,
a couple field guides, which I encourage. But either they're hurrying them up because they either need to get to the top of the mountain or to the end of the trail, or they're labeling everything. And I watch the children when that happens, and I'm watching what happens for them. It's like either they just like shift out of the curiosity, or they're like something just like deflates a little bit. Like when they're curious and they're like, come on, hurry up. And they're like, well, but bye. Oh, and I say goodbye to the butterfly.
That's,
you know,
so sad.
I've cried when I've been out before. So less is more. And creating as much as you can, a culture around this, meaning, you know, plants in the house. A lot of families have pets. And I think that that's such an amazing piece for both adults and children. to be able to connect. We are deprived of other species. And I think engaging in really having a relationship with other species is critically important. And that's why I love working with the horses up here. But I'm always looking for wildlife. So the kids, after they've been up here a number of times, they have it. They point out the beings to me before I see them, which is super cool. And it doesn't take much.
Yeah.
It really, like, two sessions, and I've got kids and they're like, "Oh my gosh, Miss Kimberly, look over here." Da, da, da. And that is so easy. All parents have to do is notice and point.
Yeah.
You know, and do that draw. Creating the culture of, yeah, having pets, having plants. And even sometimes, whether it be in a child's bedroom, and this could even be for teachers or people that work with children, or if you have children, like somewhere in the home or somewhere in a kiddo's bedroom, you know, sometimes kids, regardless of age, get put into what we have called timeouts. Sometimes we all need a little break. Right.
Yep.
How can we create an actual small space that has things and beings that are actually known to help a child co-regulate and get into their parasympathetic nervous system in those spaces?
Hmm.
For example, if there's
lots of examples.
Well, so if you think about either in a classroom or in a home, maybe there's just one little corner, and it doesn't have to be like a punishment spot. It's actually more like a Zen den.
Right. Oh, I like that, Zen den.
I use that in my dog training world. I say dogs need crates, and that's their Zen den.
Nice.
And I think humans need our version. We don't need crates. But I think we need a Zen den, and I think it could be important. So instead of having like some level of punishment where we put a kid in a timeout, whether it be in a classroom or in a home, it's like it's Zen den time. And in that space, you know, there is a plant there. There's a number of rocks there. There's seashells there. There's maybe some pictures of photographs of maybe the family on vacation in a certain place. Like there's
feathers, maybe.
Animals. What did you say?
Some feathers, maybe.
There's feathers. I mean, that's the creativity of
whoever
it is. And the child can help put that together. It's like, you know, we're going to create a safe Zen den for all of us. You know, it's going to have nature items. Like, let's go out and explore and find some things that we want to put in that space.
Hmm.
And so sometimes I think the moms and dads and guardians need to spend some time in those spaces too. We're just like, I need
Zen. Yes, we do.
We need the Zen den. So yes, so you can create your own, you know, maybe it's like right on the back porch or whatever it is, but get creative and put things there. And those things are known to help us activate our parasympathetic nervous system. So instead of a kid going there and just, you think about what you did. You
know? Stewing in anger and negativity.
It doesn't go very far.
No.
How can we help get into a place where then we actually have access to our frontal cortex and we have access to being in relationship and participating instead of reacting?
Yeah.
And nature helps us get there.
Hmm. That's powerful.
Another idea.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for those, Kimberly. That's great. That's really great. What are two or more books that you might recommend for the listeners?
I have some. I wanted to just like turn to my little library and just show you all of them, but that was well. I love books. I put my collections together.
Yes.
So a couple that I would recommend, one is How to Raise a Wild Child. You've seen that one, by Scott Sampson. And I think this is a really good book for parents. And it goes through a lot of these pieces that we've spoken to today and the rationale and that nature isn't just a hobby for kids, that this is actually our design.
Right.
And that, again, part of rewilding is us just coming back to who we are, because when we're who we are, then we're actually more free, more alive, and we make better choices and we're healthier. Yes. And this gives some ideas and some examples and some rationale of essentially raising a child that is a Homo sapien on the planet Earth.
Yes.
We're Homo sapien animals on an animate Earth, and how do you do that? So I like that book for that. Another one by another favorite author that I many people will be familiar with, which is Joseph Cornell. And this one is Deep Nature Play. This is a book that not as many people are aware of that he wrote. And it's a really awesome book. And this one doesn't have, like a lot of his books have a lot of the experiential exercises and activities to do with groups and with children. Mm-hmm. This one's a little bit more of a philosophical book. It mentions a number of activities in there as examples. And it's, I mean, it's only like 100 pages. Like this is not a big read. It's super simple, but it does talk about what we were talking about, is that the emphasis on play and how that establishes creativity, what that does for our motor skills, what that does for what I'm calling developing our bio language and our ability to be able to sense and take in the world in that quote illiterate way. But that's our first language, and to be able to maintain that so we can blend that with our language world. So yeah, this has a lot of really good rationale for that, to help make sense of the role of play in both adults and children's lives. So Deep Nature Play by Joseph Cornell. Another one I like is, I have not read this one all the way through, is Nature and Therapy. I have a lot of books on nature and therapy. I'm putting out this one. Sometimes hearing people's voices. It makes a difference, right? Like you can read somebody and sometimes when you hear the voice and I'm just like, oh, that really, your voice and your tone and your intonation and how you speak fits.
Right. Like click somehow.
Yeah, it totally clicks. And some people I'm like, oh, I liked your book, but when you talk, that's difficult. That was not the case. So Martin Jordan is the author of this book, and I heard him speak and he was interviewed, and he just sounded like a wise elder and really grounded, and was really speaking about this interweaving of nature and therapy, and he did it really well. And so that's another one that I'd recommend.
Nice.
As far as rewilding goes in general, since again, rewilding to me is also just like, it's like looking at our lifestyle, like, are we sleeping how we're designed to sleep? Are we eating how we're designed to eat? Are we moving how we're designed to move? Are we learning how we're designed to learn? All of those pieces. And unfortunately, most of those were not. The answer is no. And so having some guidance on getting back to some of those practices, and somebody that I also really love listening to, is a lot of integrity in his information and in his dedication, which is A New Path by Arthur Haynes. And this is an awesome, really holistic, big picture book on how can we live in modern times, but yet still according to our Homo sapien animal design. And
that's
to me,
trick, isn't it?
It is a trick. I'm not saying this is easy and this path is not easy. Yeah. And I think that's where accountability and buddies and mentoring and ecotherapists and rewilding classes and nature classes, and all of those come into place because it's helping us put these pieces together. But to me, this is almost like a precursory step sometimes to doing eco-based therapy. You know, it's like if I were to tell somebody like, oh, you know, there's this, we went on some trip and there was a tiger and he was so beautiful and I had to have him. And so I put him in the enclosure and he's just, something's different. He's changed. And like, I mean, I feed him, like he's fine. Like he gets some sunshine. And it's like, you say that to anybody and they're like, well, he's acting different because he's in the enclosure.
Right.
Because he's not in his natural habitat. And to me, like, we are a domesticated species.
Yeah.
So there's bound to be an outcome.
Right. Yeah. That's a wonderful metaphor for it.
To me, it just helps. So when anybody comes in for ecotherapy, whether it be a child or an adult, I'm like, well, of course, we're all living in our zoo.
Yeah.
But how can, and we can't go back. We can't go back, but we can go back to who we are as Homo sapiens, even though we're not going back in time, and we can still do some of these practices. We can still eat more diversity.
Hmm.
We can still eat seasonally. We can still move our bodies on the landscape. we can still try to get sleep for 8 hours a day without a bunch of screens for hours, like up until the moment that we fall asleep.
Right.
You know, all of these pieces are really important, and it does help us maintain health and vitality, which ends up, to me, having us have more reciprocal relationships with the people in our lives, with nature, with the planet. I mean, it's all connected. I don't do this just for us because it's good for us. I do this because when we are good, we treat others better.
Yes.
And so, yeah, those are some of my
perfect
my book recommendations.
Awesome. That's a good little library right there. So I'll, as always, put the links for those in the show notes, as well as The Power of Now, which I mentioned earlier, which is a wonderful book. And then, so how can people further connect with you and the work that you're doing, Kimberly?
Well, I guess like everybody else, there are beneficial technological structures.
Right.
Yes, my website is relationalrewilding.com. My email is wild@relationalrewilding.com. And I live in Golden, Colorado, on a little ranch, a 1 acre ranch west of Golden, Colorado in the foothills with my partner and three horses and lots of wildlife. And if anybody's anywhere near this area, I invite people to come up. Also a gift of, I think, of the work that we do here is that we're outside all the time. You know, we're not in a typical office setting in recycled air with a bunch of surfaces.
Right.
Air is, to me, part of the rewilding process. We need more of that. And so even during this challenging time of isolation and of social distancing, while a number of our clients are still actually online, and so we're trying to encourage some of these practices for people in themselves and have some accountability, but some people are also coming up here and we are maintaining social distance and we're outside the whole time. So we're not into surfaces and recycled air and all that fun stuff. Anyway, I always welcome people to come by and meet the animals, and we've got lots of plants on the property and the horses, and we're always open to just having even a brief experience up here. It's like, especially now, like it is a really stressful time. And I mean, I put out on, I think Facebook and on Instagram, I'm like, if you just need a little break and you need to connect and you need touch, like touch is really, really important. And this is also another thing with therapy. And this is what helps with working with animals and with nature, is that humans need touch. And while you can touch in therapy, a lot of people try to steer clear of that for many reasons,
right. But
we still need touch. So we can touch trees, we can touch horses, we can touch dogs, we can touch land, we can walk barefoot. Yeah. Touch is really important. And so that's something that, you know, we invite people, if you want to come up here and get some horse touch and land touch, you know, you're more than welcome to do that. My Instagram is mountain.herbivore. And yeah, I've got a couple classes and trainings coming up. I'm not totally sure if they'll be canceled or not. I've got some plant classes, some general rewilding classes. I'm doing a training to train therapists on ecotherapy at the end of July.
Oh, cool.
And I'm planning on having some more of those throughout the year. And an aspect of that I really emphasize is, if somebody is interested in doing ecotherapy, you want to work toward having an unconscious competence in that side piece. So for example, if you're going to do therapy and you're going to do nature, you need to have a lot of information and awareness of and connection to nature.
Right.
If you're going to work with horses, you need to have an unconscious competence with horses. You can't be trying to figure out horses while you're working with somebody. You can't try to figure out nature and what meeting, coming face to face with an animal mean. Like, you need to know that stuff ahead of time, because you're having to divert your awareness in so many different areas. You can't be guessing.
It needs to be an intuitive thing at that point.
It needs to be completely intuitive. Yes, absolutely. And so that's a piece that I like to work with in my trainings that I do, is we're actually going to we're going to reignite eco-literacy. and nature awareness. Because when you have that, that promotes creativity in your therapeutic sessions. So that's a piece of what I teach when I teach about ecotherapy, is teaching those pieces. I love connecting. I like partnering with people. If there's anybody kind of local area, if they want to maybe do programs together. So many people have so many different skills, and I only know a few. And so if people have other skills that are collateral with this, you know, they want to put a program or a class together, I love doing that as well.
Awesome. Good deal. Well, I'll have all that information, of course, in the show notes as well for those who want to connect with Kimberly in person or virtually. And thanks so much, Kimberly. This has been a very enlightening and fulfilling conversation, and I'm sure that will come across on the other end of the listener. So thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
I totally agree. And if I can, I want to say thank you to you and the project that you're doing in this piece, and kind of almost like how you're bringing so many different threads together and so many people together through this platform, as well as doing a lot of education and inspiration. I also have to acknowledge just some of the teachers. Like, I feel like I'm only here doing this because
absolutely
I have so many teachers and mentors. And one of them is my partner, Dewey Freeman, who's a master therapist, master horseman. Mm. He's incredible. And so much of even what I've shared today is inspired by and is what I've learned and integrated from my work with him. John Stokes, I had mentioned, is another teacher of mine. He's in New Mexico and runs the tracking project.
Yes. Yeah. I'll put that in there as well.
Yeah. He's amazing. John Young in the Wilderness Awareness School. And I've done some trainings with Eight Shields Institute as well. I've done a number of herbalist plant programs that I'm so grateful for. And Shelley Torgove, and she's here in this area, and she's been instrumental at helping me deepen my relationship with land and with plants. And all of this is just, it makes me who I am. And it feels really important to acknowledge those people.
Yes. Here. Yeah. Thank you for that. And I'll definitely put links to all those people on here. We're all about connecting and building networks, and we all stand on the shoulders of giants for sure.
Yes.
So thank you for that. And then acknowledging as well, and I saw this on your website and really appreciated it, and acknowledging the indigenous peoples whose lands we currently habitate.
Yes.
That's an important piece as well. And
absolutely.
Acknowledging and recognizing that. So,
yep.
Very good. Thank you, Kimberly. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Yeah, you too. Thank you, friends. As always, I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I know it was a longer one on this time around, but what a fun conversation, and what a wonderful ecotherapist and someone who's doing a lot of good in the world. So really appreciate Kimberly for coming on and sharing her knowledge and experience and wisdom with us. And on that note, please go check out Kimberly's website, check out her Instagram. If you do have questions or anything, feel free to shoot her an email. She's in the Golden, Colorado area, which is near Denver. So those in Colorado or surrounding areas who could, use Kimberly's services, highly, highly recommend her. So check that out. Feel free to check out the show notes with all the links to all the books we mentioned and the institutions and people that we talked about as well. We're all about, again, like I said in the episode, all about facilitating that collaboration. And so, please go and check these kinds of people out. We're all in this together. We're all trying to do good things for people, the natural world and the earth as a whole. And it only works if we all work together and continue to build this community. So please go check that out as well. And as always, we love reviews. Wherever it is you're finding this, please feel free to go on and leave a review. That's super helpful. It lets others know the value that we're putting out here with the podcast. Also, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Not super active on social media other than when doing posts, but hopefully get better with that in the future. But always feel free to reach out and send me a message on either one of those platforms, or you can email me directly to ron@coyotespath.com. And I always love hearing from you. And I do get to hear from you all now and then.
and really, really appreciate that. So until next time, happy trails. Get out there. Have some fun.